This afternoon, you are tuned into a Juno afternoon here for Friday, the 2nd of December, the year 2016. I'm Jeff Brown, I'll be your host for today. We'll be profiling artists Katie Craney and Margot Connolly Mason, who are showcasing their work at the First Friday at the Jack next door. We'll find out about activities downtown. Bruce Simonson will offer a preview of this weekend's concert by the Juno Box Society. And Sarah Hass will be here to highlight her new massage bar opening Monday. That Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, Music and More today on a Juno afternoon. Well, the forecast for tonight, showers, low temperatures around 34 degrees. Forecast for Saturday, rain showers likely before 7 in the morning, then snow showers. High temperatures near 36. Forecast for Saturday night, showers, snow showers likely, mostly before 4 a.m.
This is National Native News. I'm Art Hughes, in for Antonio Gonzalez. A federal judge Thursday turned down a temporary restraining order requested by Dakota Access Pipeline protesters. Chief Judge Daniel L. Hovland rejected the request because he said the plaintiff's attorneys failed to provide written notice of the request to all the law enforcement agencies involved. The restraining order request was a part of a larger class action lawsuit against the Morton County Sheriff's Office and other agencies, triggered by a particularly violent confrontation almost 2 weeks ago. A coalition of attorneys called the Water Protector Legal Collective is spearheading the lawsuit. Members of an Oregon legal group that's part of the coalition compares the Dakota Access Pipeline confrontation to clashes over civil rights in the 60s. Rachel McDonald reports.
On November 20th, DAPL protesters, or water protectors, walked onto a bridge that had been blocked by police vehicles. Attorney Lauren Regan with Eugene-based Civil Liberties Defense Center says a small group tried to move one of the vehicles.
And when they moved that vehicle to the side of the road, law enforcement began arriving in heavy numbers. And basically what ensued over the next 5 hours was probably one of the most brutal, unethical, unlawful attacks against nonviolent protesters since the 1960s.
Regan compares it to the civil rights protests in Selma, Alabama. On November 20th, police in North Dakota used tear gas, rubber bullets, and fire hoses on protesters. Regan says more than 300 people were injured or sickened. The lawsuit calls on the court for a temporary restraining order against police. The Morton County Sheriff's Office did not return calls for comment, but a news release on their website calls the bridge incident on November 20th a riot. The sheriff says some protesters have been instigating violence. For National Native News, I'm Rachel McDonald in Eugene, Oregon.
The Standing Rock Sioux tribe spoke out against the pipeline route in meetings with pipeline executives 2 years before the tribe's lawsuit to halt the project. The tribe released audio this week of that meeting in September 2014. The audio contradicts claims by company representatives that the tribe never formally expressed their opposition during the pipeline planning stage. The Bismarck Tribune reports the audio is from a meeting that occurred 3 months before Energy Transfer Partners applied for a permit from the North Dakota Public Service Commission and 20 months before the start of construction. Organizers of the ongoing protest in North Dakota are starting to welcome hundreds of veterans from all over the country. As many as 2,000 veterans are traveling by car, bus, and even on foot to the camps to protest the pipeline. People camped out on the Army Corps of Engineers land face a Monday evacuation order deadline. North Dakota's governor and the Army Corps both asked the protesters to leave. Neither of the entities says it plans to forcibly remove the people occupying the land. The Facebook page for the Morton County Sheriff's Office often contains posts critical of the protest effort. One post on Thursday included comments from Cass County Sheriff Paul D. Laney, who says he and other officers were troubled by the display of an upside-down American flag.
And to flaunt it in front of those of us who have taken an oath to uphold it and defend it just didn't sit well.
The post shows video of law enforcement officials using an official airboat to retrieve the flag when no protesters were around. The town of Barrow, Alaska now goes by its original Inupiaq name, Utqagaqvik. Residents narrowly approved the name change in October. A little over 4,000 people live in the town above the Arctic Circle. The changeover will take some time. Opponents of the name change say they're concerned about the cost to change out signs, documents, maps, websites, and other places where the current name is displayed. With National Native News, I'm Art Hughes.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
The Albuquerque Hispano Chamber of Commerce's Convention and Tourism Department welcomes to Albuquerque the 6th annual Striking Eagle Basketball Tournament and Education Fair beginning December 28th. Information on the event and services at siabq.org.
And by the law firm of Sanosky Chambers, Saxe, Miller & Munson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States, with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
It's 6 minutes past the hour, New York, 2-2, June afternoon. Our first guests in the studio are artists Katie Craney and Margot Conley Mason, who are showcasing their work during the first Friday next door at the Jack. Thank you for being on the show with me today.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Jeff.
So, you two have never met before.
We met about 2 weeks ago in Haines, actually. Margot was up there for work, and that is where I live, and we were lucky enough to briefly meet before deciding to figure out how to have a show together.
Katie, are you a full-time artist in Haines?
Aspiring to be.
Tell me about the materials you use.
Oh, I use a smattering of things, and it's a lot of experimentation, but I mostly work on small pieces of metal, found metal, scrap metal that I find laying around, recycling station, wherever I can find it, and I layer silver leaf, pencil, ink drawings on tissue paper, and gauze, and blueberry dyed cheesecloth, and I put a lot of that onto the surface with encaustic hot wax. So there's kind of a lot of things happening, and it's a lot of fun, but sometimes I never really know what's going to happen.
How was the cheesecake?
It was actually juice. I made blueberry juice this summer, and I really loved what happened to the cheesecloth. I couldn't bring myself to clean it or wash it, so it has become part of the art.
Now, your work is mostly fairly small. Why do you choose to work small?
I think it started as a necessity because I was traveling a lot and small was easier. And now I've really become, I'm really interested in keeping things small. I like it the way it draws the viewer into it. You have to get close to it and spend a lot of time with it. So I just really appreciate the aesthetic of small work.
An aspiring full-time artist.
Working towards it. It's, it doesn't always pay the bills, but I work on it probably more than I work on anything else, so I guess you could say it's full-time.
Cool. And Margot Conley Mason, from Juneau.
From Massachusetts originally, but I've been in Juneau for the past 2.5 years and lived in Kodiak for a little while before that.
Could you describe your work, please?
Sure. So mine, I use oil paint on canvas, so nothing super exciting like blueberry dyed cheesecloth. But I do mostly, this show has turned out to be larger scale pieces. I think of them as sort of object portraits. So of things like boots and dead fish and shells and hammers and screwdrivers, sort of everyday objects that I think look really interesting and lots of neat shadows and shapes. So it almost looks like, the object is stuck to the wall. That's sort of my aspiration for a lot of my pieces.
How long have you been an artist?
I'm not a professionally, or formally trained artist, so it's always just been something that I've done in my free time. But I've been, drawing and doodling since I was little, and my dad is actually a really talented artist, which he just discovered after he retired from being a lawyer. So I think I have it in my blood a little bit, but definitely it's something that I kind of go in waves of putting more attention on it and less, depending on what else is going on in my life.
Well, I guess being a lawyer is kind of an art form in itself.
Right. They have more performance art.
When you're looking at something to paint, do you just have lots of shells in your house?
I do have lots of shells in my house, actually, from the East Coast and West Coast. So I have jars of them, in the bathroom and my bedroom, and I have a little art room in my house. So I like to do, wherever I'm living, I like to do art that's from that place specifically. So when I was living in Massachusetts, I did a lot of quahogs and whelks and things that I could find on the beaches there. And then here in Alaska, I'm doing horse clams and mussels and oysters and cockles, and then grundins and extra tufts, and so things that are very specific to the places where I'm living.
Do you remember your first piece where you said, I'm an artist?
I think the first time I actually sold something had a big impact on me, and that was when I was living in Kodiak. I sold a little shell, it was probably maybe 3x5, at the Next Page bookstore that was open there, and I had put some things on display, and, you know, just I was excited to have people look at it, and then the owner called me up and said that someone wanted to buy it, and I was astonished that I could actually do that. So that opened up a lot of doors for me, and there's a really great arts community in Kodiak and in Juneau, so I'm really appreciative of these communities that I've lived in Alaska.
Katie, do you remember your first soul piece?
Oh, gosh. I guess I've always been an artist since I was a kid, and I remember a friend of our parents, my parents, they asked me to do a portrait drawing of their kids. So I did that as my first sold piece, and haven't sold a whole lot since then. I'm just kidding. But no, it's getting there. It's definitely a process of learning how to put yourself out there, and I'm really excited to have a show here in Juneau. This is my first time showing my work here, and excited to be reaching out to the broader Alaska community with my work.
Or if I could excerpt a little bit from your statement. These pieces of wood, metal, leather, or calcium carbonate transform anonymous objects to old friends with lives and adventures of their own.
I like to think that. I read, I don't know if you're familiar with Tom Robbins, the author, but he's, you know, a little quirky, but there's this one book that I really liked of his. I can never remember the title, but it's essentially about a spoon and a can of beans and a shell, and they go traveling across the country, and a dirty sock, I think, is involved as well. And so just that book, which I read years ago, got me thinking about, you know, lives of these objects that we have around us all the time, and, you know, where are they trying to go, and what do they want to do, and, you know, what if I pick up this dirty sock on the beach? Is that where I want it to be? So I think sometimes when I'm painting my objects, I think about what adventures they might be having, you know, the boot that's in my closet, like, maybe he doesn't really want to be there. Maybe it's rather, you know, been a roller coaster in Hawaii. So just giving a little bit more life to some of these things that we might take for granted otherwise.
I've talked to several artists, but none of them have said they were inspired by a dirty sock.
Well done, Margo. Well done.
Katie, what about you? What inspires you?
Oh, I spend a lot of time thinking about the place that I surround myself with. That's why I live in Alaska. And I think especially with how the world is changing pretty quickly, I think a lot about climate change and how it's affecting this place that I love so much. And it's kind of this deep-rooted sense of urgency that I have to do what I can to at least maybe preserve or show what I find is beautiful in the world. And I don't know if it's not necessarily trying to change anybody's opinion or mind, but it's just something that kind of helps me cope a little bit with seeing things change, but also just an expression and trying to capture what I think is important.
We talked a little bit about what inspires you, but who inspires you?
Who? Oh, gosh. I feel like Southeastern Alaska in general inspires me. I lived in Gustavus for about 4 years, and I will never forget Kim Hecox's favorite quote. He says, you know, we all come here for the place, but we stay for the people. And I think that's really true about Alaska in general. I think we really hold each other up and make a better community because of it, because we're all kind of hunkering down and here because we want to be. And I think that's a really precious thing to have about living up here.
Margo, who inspires you?
I really like what Katie said and her expression there. And I would say also I'm just, yeah, inspired by the places that I'm living and things that I'm seeing and people that I'm seeing, you know, and things that they're using and things that are part of their everyday lives. And when I lived in Kodiak, I worked for a fish and game doing dockside sampling. So, you know, I was always out in the rain and the dark and the cold and looking at totes of fish, and I had a hacksaw, I'd cut cod heads open, and I feel like that really allowed me to see a different side of the community and things that were, you know, really hardworking people and just a different beauty that you don't always see with the landscape or, you know, sort of the typical Alaskan, you know, mountains and waters and things, but more a little bit grittier side of things, and that I think is a big inspiration for me.
Dirty socks and dead fish.
Dirty socks and dead fish. Yo, come on down to the Jack. You can get everything you want.
How long of the time period have you been spent making the pieces that you'll be on show today?
I have 14 pieces. So everything was done since I've moved to Juneau. It's an L.L. Bean boot I did pretty soon after I moved here because I was wearing them every single day because of all the rain here. Each piece takes, it's a variety of time. I have, my biggest one is 4 canvases that all work together, and it's a tote of dead fish from Seward that I saw when I was over there this summer. And that one took a couple of months working on it when I was traveling a lot for work. And so whenever I'd be home, I'd make sure, you know, I had to lock myself in my room for a few hours at a time and make sure I worked on that. So, you know, 2.5 years kind of total for the collection, but most of my work has been done within the past several months.
Katie, how about you?
Same. I had a show in Anchorage that opened October 1st, so I was busy making all of that work, and I thought, well, whatever I have from Anchorage I could bring down here, but I actually decided to change directions completely for the show in Juneau, and I made all the work in the last month and a half. I think I have 17 pieces total, but one of the pieces is a series of 50, but they're all very small, 2.5 by 3 inches. And the other pieces are, I think the largest is maybe 5.5 by 6. So I don't work very large, so it's easy to make a lot of pieces in a short amount of time.
I've been talking with Katie Craney and Margot Connolly Mason. We're showcasing their work during First Friday at Gallery Walk tonight at the Jack. You didn't know each other up to a few weeks ago. But is there something that you've seen when you see your work together that complements each other?
Yeah, I think it works really well together, and it was really great to meet Katie because I feel like we have very similar, you know, inspirations for our work, even though they come out looking pretty different, but very place-based. And I think the juxtaposition of her small pieces and the series of multiples is really interesting to see against my more singular, larger pieces. So I don't want to give too much away, but people just have to come and see them. But I think they work really well together.
Yeah, I agree. It was really exciting to see your work. And I've had some obsessions with fish as well, so that was kind of fun. I do have a few pieces that have some fish in them, so that was kind of fun to just see different ways that we represent something that we appreciate so much.
I think Gallery Walk goes until about 9 o'clock tonight, so you've got a busy night ahead of you. Thank you so much for coming down to the station.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday. It's the 2nd of December, 2016. It's the birthday of novelist Elizabeth Berg, born 1948, St. Paul, Minnesota. Most recent novel is Tapestry of Fortunes. It's the birthday of the author George Sanders, 1958, in Amarillo, Texas, grew up on the south side of Chicago. It's the birthday of the painter Georges Seurat, born in Paris, 1859, painted huge canvases with tiny dots of many colors, which became known as pointillism, most famous painting Sunday afternoon on the island of La Grande Jetée. It took him about 2 years to paint it. It's the birthday of the engineer Peter Carl Goldmark, born in Budapest in 1906, came to this country and was hired by the Columbia Broadcasting System Laboratory, where he began working on a prototype for color television. He invented one, but the problem was it did not work with the black and white televisions that were already in people's homes, so it did not come into use. He also developed an electronic video recording system, which led to the development of the VCR. But CBS did not care for it because they didn't like the idea of people recording things in their homes. They thought it would hurt the broadcasting business, so nothing happened with it. But one of his inventions stood the test of time, and that was the long-playing record. He found a new, more flexible material for records, made the grooves narrower so that he could get the equivalent of 6 78 RPM records onto 1 33 1/3 LP, which became then the industry standard until CDs became popular in the 1980s. And it's the birthday of the novelist and essayist Ann Patchett, born in Los Angeles, 1963. Grew up in Nashville, Tennessee, best known for her novel Bel Canto, which begins with 57 men, 18 terrorists, and an opera singer holed up in a Peruvian mansion. She loved bookstores when she was a kid, and eventually she opened her own in Nashville and called it Parnassus. Her latest book, Commonwealth, is about her life growing up with four step-siblings. Here's a poem for today by William Stafford, Hometown. Peace on my little town, a speck in the safe, comforting, impersonal immensity of Kansas. Benevolence like a gentle haze on its courthouse, the model of Greek pillars to me, on its quiet little bombshell of a library, on its continuous, hidden, efficient sewer system. Sharp, amazed, steadfast regard on its more upright citizenry, my nosy, incredible, delicious neighbors. Haunting invasion of a train whistle to my friends, moon gilding regular breaths of the old memories to them, the old whispers, old attempts, old beauties, ever new. Peace on my little town. Haze blessed, sun friended, dreaming sleepy days under the world champion sky. Hometown, a poem by William Stafford from Another World Instead, published by Grey Wolf Press, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, a monthly devoted to discovering and publishing new voices in poetry, more at poetryfoundation.org, and by Staples, offering printer ink and toner cartridges for home and business, with in-store print shops offering customized presentations, booklets, and manuals. In-store and online, Staples, make more happen. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
It's 22 minutes past the hour, and you are tuned into a Juno Afternoon. Our next guests are in the studio are Dina Harrington and Charlie Harrington. Dina Hendren and Charlie Harrington from the Hangar and Wharf and the Downtown Business Association.
Thanks, Jeff.
Here to talk about things that are going on in downtown. Thanks so much for coming.
Thank you. We're getting ready for Gallery Walk. It's going to be a beautiful evening, rain or shine or rain or wind. We're expecting everyone to come out to our party on Front Street. Starts right at 4 p.m. We're going to have a great holiday sweater walk where we have six chances for people to win the gift of downtown. So a bunch of downtown businesses got together and put together gift certificates. So we have a lot of great prizes for people. That's right at 8 p.m. We have live entertainment and a lot of great activations and experiences going on in the stores themselves. A lot of people will have artists up and a lot of food and drink. So we're going to have a great evening in downtown.
How many members are in the Downtown Business Association?
We currently have about 80 members, and we're in our membership drive right now, so we're looking to increase that. So membership drive ends at the end of this year. So today's a great time to go and see all the different member businesses and to see what the Downtown Business Association is comprised of. And this year actually is the first year that the DBA rented a lot. So the lot in between the public library and Tracy's Crab Shack is where we're going to have some free parking for DBA. So be sure to park your car there. There's about 70 spots, so first come, first served.
There's a lot of free parking today, which is good.
Yeah, there's a lot of free parking. And I think the free parking for the city started at 3 p.m., so people can grab their spots now.
How many people do you expect to get Gallery Walk this year?
Well, last year, I feel like we had a couple thousand. I mean, it seemed bustling, so I expect a pretty decent crowd now. I know we're all used to this kind of weather, and we live in Alaska in a rainforest, so I still expect people to come out and enjoy, this holiday season with all their friends and family.
Now, when I hear about sweater contests, I usually think about ugly sweaters.
Well, there will be ugly sweaters, and there will be nice, cute sweaters, too. So anything that you consider a holiday sweater, we consider a holiday sweater. So the way it goes is you go into participating businesses. So they'll have this holiday sweater logo on the doors or windows of their businesses. And you go in, you fill out a ticket with your name, and you take that ticket to Front Street, and there's going to be a big present box at the DJ booth. So you put your ticket in there, and at 8 p.m. sharp, Santa and Mrs. Claus are going to be pulling out six names, and those will be the winners of these six different gifts.
So quality of the sweater isn't necessarily the factor.
Yeah, exactly.
And you've got Front Street closed off.
Yeah, we do. It's actually closed off now until 10 p.m. DJ Manu is setting up. So we have that whole street just for people to go and mingle and have fun and walk around. I know Ben Franklin always comes out and, you know, they demonstrate some of their toys there. People dress up in costumes. I'll be there handing out candy canes and glow sticks. So a lot of fun things will be going on. Definitely some dancing in the street. I know DJ Manu has some lights that he's going to be projecting out into the street. And so it's going to be a lot of fun. Right after we announce the winners for the Holiday Sweater Walk, we're going to have one huge group photo for a gallery walk. It's going to be the first ever gallery walk group photo. Michael Penn is going to be there to take the shot. So we really want everyone to come on Front Street a little after 8, well, at 8 to hear the winners and to maybe be a winner. And then right after that, we'll be doing the group photo. So it's going to be really cool. So I want everyone to come with their holiday sweaters, their raincoats, and their rain boots.
And Charlie Harrington from the Hangar on the Wharf, thank you for coming by.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Jeff. Yeah, so right after gallery walk in the group photo and the Santa giving away the sweater, make sure you come by the Hangar. We just renovated our ballroom, and tonight is the grand unveiling. And it's really nice. Can't wait to share it with the community. And we've got a free show. So first group will go on about 8:30. It's Juno Soul. They're a funk group made up of a bunch of local band members, and then Jocelyn Miles and Al Dunn. And then afterwards, DJ Manu is going to take his gear and head over and close the night down. So it should be a really good Friday night here in downtown Juneau.
Before the interview, we talked about various people who have worked at the Hangar, and it seems like most people in Juneau have.
Yeah, at some point, you know, you're around for 20 years. It seems like everyone has been there at some point or another, especially in the summer season. Yeah.
What kind of other things do you have going on in the future for the DBA?
Well, we actually on Thursday, I believe it's the 18th or 19th, we're going to have Gifts and Girlfriends. So it's like a girls' night out shopping, and a bunch of the stores will be open late, and we'll, maybe some will have some wine or some cocktails or something like that. But it'll be like a girls' shopping event. And then the 16th, we have Wrap It Up Juno, where a bunch of stores will be providing free gift wrapping, and the DBA will have a DBA-sponsored gift wrapping location as well, where you can just get all your presents wrapped. And then we have Last Minute Frolic Attack, which is the last week before Christmas, that a lot of the stores will be open later, so you can get all those gifts that you didn't get when you had enough time for online shipping. So we have a full lineup of things going on, and today's definitely the biggest one, so we hope everyone comes out tonight. Party on Front Street.
David and Charlie, thank you for coming.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Jeff. Thank you, sir.
When you're alone and life is making you lonely, you can always go downtown. When you've got worries, all the noise and the hurry seems to help, I know. Downtown, just listen to the music of the traffic in the city. Linger on the sidewalk where the neon signs are pretty. How can you lose? The lights are much brighter there. You can't forget all your troubles, forget all your cares, so go down. Don't hang around and let your problems surround you. There are movie shows downtown. Maybe you know some little places to go to where they never close. Downtown, just listen to the rhythm of a
Everybody singing along in the studio with us, Downtown by Petula Clark. In the studio with you now, not necessarily singing along, Bruce Simonson and Steve Tana here to talk about the Juno Bach Society.
Great. Hi.
Wow, this Bach.
Hi, Jeff. Well, Petula Clark's pretty great, too. I have that on vinyl. So we're doing a Bach concert this weekend, tomorrow night, Saturday, at Northern Light at 8 o'clock, and then at Chapel Up by the Lake on Sunday at 3 o'clock. And it's a program with Bach and also a little bit by Corelli.
So it would be my question, why all this Bach?
Why all this Bach? Because there's a lot of it to do, and I have a passion for it, and it turns out the community does too. We have 45 people who are singing in the choir, and they keep coming back for rehearsals, so it's something that people want to do. Orchestra, we have about 16, 18 in the orchestra this time around, and they're really good. And of course, when the music comes together, it's just like the greatest thing. I really love it.
What do you love about Bach?
I like the way he treats the text. It leads to, you can think about it. It's sort of like Shakespeare. The more you dig into it, the deeper it gets. I think that's true of the music of Bach. So the introspective intellectual side, it's very satisfying for me. And yet, when he decides to write something just for beauty's sake, it's always there. Really takes advantage of the capabilities of instruments, really understands how those things work, each instrument works, as well as voices, their strengths and ways to exploit them to full advantage. So I just think he's a great composer, and there's a lot of music there to do, so I'm really looking forward to it.
Steve, what about Bach? It excites you.
What about Bach? Well, as Bruce kind of mentioned, he really knew how to write for a variety of instruments. I mean, he was an organist by trade, of course, being employed by, the church. However, there's a piece on the program that will just melt everybody's heart, the second movement of the oboe violin concerto. Boy, is it gorgeous. It may be 300 and XX years old, but it sounds just as amazing as it ever did. And I don't know, Bruce, correct me if I'm wrong. Did he ever hear that performed live in his lifetime?
Oh.
Probably not, huh?
Well, I think he did this one in Köthen when he was in his period between religious gigs in Weimar and Leipzig. He was working on instrumental pieces, not necessarily with a church service in mind. And I think he actually had some really good musicians in Köthen as well as Leipzig. So he probably did hear it. And I think Steve is right. The middle movement of this oboe violin concerto is one that you would take out on a desert island or maybe a wet monsoon Juno afternoon, if it's all the only music you could take with you.
At least Admiralty Island.
At least Admiralty, yeah, that's right.
Is Bach difficult to play, per se, or does it matter according to the piece?
Yes and no. I guess it's a matter of playing the period style, because there's a certain, at least as a violin player, I can tell that there's a certain bow stroke involved, there's a certain vibrato involved, there's a certain ensemble.
where you have to play very cleanly. You have to play, you know, it's not like a 300-piece orchestra where you can hide as a violinist, as a violin player, a string player in a Bach chamber piece like we're playing in a very small setting or in a church, which is a traditional setting. You really have to be on your toes. You have to be articulate. You have to be clean. And, boy, it's kind of like the gears of a clock. You really, if it skips a gear, you're in big trouble.
That's a good analogy. Steve says, is it easy or hard? It's easy for him to say it's easy. No, I think that's right.
Hardly.
It's great having Steve on the program. It's great.
I just can't imagine Steve hiding in the orchestra.
Oh, well, that's probably true. I mean, his talent is always present. At least you can hear it.
That's
great. Yeah.
How many pieces are you playing?
This concert has four major works on it. There's let's start from the back. The second half of the program is a cantata, number 70, composed for orchestra and full chorus and four soloists. The first half of the program is chamber music. There's an organ piece for organ. Steve mentioned Bach was very proficient on the organ, would improvise, was often called on to test out new instruments to see if they really met specifications and that kind of thing. This particular work is being performed by Laurie Clough. It's called the St. Anne Fugue, and it's the last piece in a collection that Bach put together in his middle life that says these are the kinds of things you really need to be able to play if you're going to play the organ well. And the St. Anne Fugue is one of those monuments, too, for that particular instrument, for the organ. It's going to be great to hear that. And then we mentioned the oboe violin concerto that has features Steve on violin and on oboe is Jetta Whitaker. I've been looking forward to this for a long time to have the two of them do this piece of work in Juneau. They're really talented. And then the last piece begins the program, and it's really a delight to do this. Steve recommended that we do a piece by Corelli, who lived a generation before Bach and started kind of a movement saying, you know, let's feature instruments in the orchestra instead of just having ensemble playing. We'll give instruments a chance to show off their technique and style, and really created the concerto movement, which flourished around 1700 to 1725, at least a Baroque version of that. And so it's great to have that, and we are really lucky. Lindsay Clark and David Miller and Artemio Sandoval are all local musicians, young musicians, recently graduated from college, and they're starting this concert, and they're going to really knock your socks off. It's really great. So I've talked a lot, but and you might want to add to that, Steve.
Totally agree. The Corelli is, it's kind of like, you know, here in Southeast, we're so used to stormy, cloudy winter weather, and Bach, you know, he was used to that in northern Germany, right? Köthen, yeah. And, well, Leipzig probably not so much, but, I mean, the Corelli is just like, think of sunshine, think of prosciutto, think of pasta, think of the Mediterranean, think of just Italy. And it's going to be so great for winter. It's going to be the ray of sunshine that starts our show, and it's really going to be fabulous with great soloists, young Junoites, keeping the tradition going, and we're really, really excited for that.
Yeah, they're doing a great job. It's going to be great.
It's going to be great.
What inspired you to pick these pieces and put them together in the particular order that you put it in?
Oh, it was a bit of a push. It was a difficult decision. I mean, the cantata was sort of obvious for the second half. But the first is like, you want to put the organ piece between the two pieces or whatever. And I think actually the order is right. And because of the contrast, we have really a Corelli violin, double violin concerto that sort of starts the thing. Says, oh, I think about this and then, you know, 50 years later, this is what happened out of that tradition. You get this oboe violin concerto by Bach, which I think is just really a spectacular comparison. And then I wanted to do the organ piece just because we don't hear enough organ playing, at least this kind of organ playing. And Laurie Clough's a good friend of mine. I said, hey, Laurie, what do you think? And she thought about it, and she was up traveling in the Southeast. And when I mentioned it to her, she started looking up organs and trying it out. And I knew that she knew this piece from her college days, and so she's really been looking forward to performing it. And she's tried it out on both organs, the one at Northern Light on Saturday night and the one at Chapel by the Lake on Sunday, and really looking forward to it. So I wanted to get the organ piece on there, too. So,
what kind of things were going on in Bach's lifetime and concern the greater population which he lived in?
Well, something I recently read is that Leipzig was a university town. That's where Bach spent the last 20 years of his life, 25 years of his life. as a chief musician, church musician in town, a very important position. And I read recently it was the biggest university town in Germany. They had full professorships, like 40 of them. You know, like most, I guess other ones were nowhere near that. And then assistant professors, full. So it's really an intellectual town. It was also a publishing town. So books were published in Leipzig. So it was really like the hotbed of German thought at the time. So Bach's audiences, some of them were really very, very well educated. And I think he had that in mind. So when he was writing his music, he knew that they would be inspired by it and understand it. Maybe not in the moment, but if they cared to delve into it, they could do that too, as they studied with Bach. Bach had at least 60 students and maybe 100 that he taught while he was in Leipzig. And so I think, to answer your question, what was around it is his time. That particular part of his life, it was really a very, you know, it was German and deep-thinking people. And I think that coupled with his responsibility in the church to perform music appropriate for the church service, coupled with the sermons that must have happened at the same time, and they're actually pretty famous too. There's a lot of deep thought involved in them. And I think it was just a very intellectual, inspiring time for Bach. I think he was glad when he got to Leipzig and really produced quite a bit of his compositions were from Leipzig period. Tune of like one major cantata a week for about 4 years. Can you imagine doing that? I mean, I can't imagine it, but the pace that he set for himself. So he was obviously inspired and wrote a lot of great music most of the time. I don't think that, you know, that you might think about things like plague and all that. I don't think that was present immediately. I don't think he actually had to live through that, but it's certainly aware of it. You know, those plagues we go through and the pestilence and things like that which would inspire his compositions when those kinds of scriptures come up. But I think I was going to say that it wasn't an easy life. I mean, most children died before the age of five. I mean, it was from whatever, you know, diseases and things like that. Didn't have the benefit of biotics and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And so I think Bach lost all but six of his kids mm-hmm. before they reached puberty, something like that.
Two sets of twins died, I think, because he had 16 kids, right?
Yeah.
Which is good when you don't have a Xerox machine to copy all of your parts up for the Sunday service. You got your kids to copy them, right? So that's great.
That's true, actually. They did do that.
Yeah. And I'll let you know what he did during all those winter German nights.
Exactly. He drank beer and was very creative.
Yeah. What do you learn about music when you play Bach?
What do I learn? Well, you know, it's the foundation. It's the pillar of certainly a violin instrumental playing technique. You learn the Bach solo sonatas, and boy, that's your foundation. You can play just about anything after you know your basics. I think for a 300-whatever-year-old guy, like I said, 1685 was he born?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Oh, my God. It's. I don't think they'll be playing Michael Jackson in 345 years. They might.
They might. Yeah, but it's a different thing. It'll be listening to it, not performing it.
Probably right.
Yeah.
I mean, think about it that way.
certainly Bach has stood the test of time, and it could have been lost. The tradition of these church musicians was that they just set aside their predecessors' music and started over. Mm-hmm. At least some did. I actually say most did. And Bach would have been forgotten if it hadn't been for Mendelssohn, who said, hey, this is pretty cool, and he mounted a production of the St. Matthew Passion, and that initiated a program to see if they can collect all the works of Bach. If it hadn't been for Mendelssohn, we probably would have lost the much of the literature we currently have, and we probably lost half of it anyway, actually.
Or he might be playing Michael Jackson songs during this next concert coming up.
That's true. We might be doing something like that. Yeah.
We still could.
It could happen.
Elvis,
yeah.
This weekend, can you give me the details of the concerts again, please?
Sure, I'll try to go slow, just so people know. So this is Friday night. So tomorrow, Saturday night, at Northern Light at 8 o'clock, we start. And on Sunday afternoon, we're at Chapel by the Lake. That's the one out by UAS, University of Alaska, out there at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. So 8 o'clock on Saturday night downtown, 3 o'clock Sunday afternoon out at UAS, Chapel by the Lake.
And how long is the concert?
Concert will run about an hour and 20 minutes, I think, something like that. We might have an intermission. It'll run 10, so probably be an hour and a half. And we expect to have a reception afterward and chats for people to enjoy themselves. So, yeah.
Thanks for coming by. Bruce Simonson and Steve Tonnes.
Thanks.
Thank you, Jeff.
This Friday at evening at Egan, join Dr. Heidi Pearson, UAS Assistant Professor for Marine Biology, for her presentation on Blue Carbon Ecosystem Services Provided by Marine Mammals. Dive into the fascinating world of marine mammals, such as humpback whales and sea otters, and learn how their feeding activity helps combat climate change by increasing the ocean's ability to absorb carbon dioxide. This is Blue Carbon Ecosystems this Friday, December 2nd, 7 p.m. at the UAS Auckland campus.
It's 47 minutes past the hour, and you are tuned into June Afternoon. Our next guest is Sarah Hoffey. She's here to highlight a new massage bar opening Monday. Sarah, thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
So your name of your business is the Juno Massage Bar.
Yes.
What is massage?
Massage, well, it's a manipulation of soft tissue. And this is specifically going to be chair massage, so it'll be clothes on, but it'll be just as effective. It'll be easily accessible to the general public, specifically the people in the airport. And, yeah, there's all sorts of different forms of it, but this is just going to be generally sports massage, stretching. There'll be a 15-minute segment offered, as well as a 30-minute, and then we'll do hand and arm massage. Those things are all subject to change as we progress, but that's the starting menu for massage concession.
What kind of training did you take to accomplish this?
I went to Body Mechanics School of Myotherapy and Massage in Olympia, Washington, about 6 years ago, and I've been training under my father, Robert Hasse, for the last 6 years. We teach massage therapy. It's a nationally accredited continuing education course that we teach to the entire nation, and I've been mentoring under him, and so injury treatment is my specialty, and that's kind of what I'm going to be bringing, as well as relaxation massage, to the concession bar.
How long is a typical massage?
Typically, if you go to a medical office, they're about 60 minutes. They can be 90 minutes. These ones in the airport are going to be 15 to 30 just because time is of the essence and you've got to catch a flight. So it's one of those things that has to be short, but generally 60 minutes.
Where exactly is the massage bar open?
So there's going to be two locations. There's going to be one inside of security for part of the day and one outside. The one inside is going to be where the vending machines used to be. There are going to be, the vending machines are going to move, and there's going to be one chair there, and that'll be for the first half of the day, and then the mid part of the day, we're going to go downstairs, and there'll be one next to the Alaska seaplanes, and that one will catch the people that are stuck in limbo if they're missing a flight due to weather, or just people that are waiting for those flights that can't quite get upstairs because Alaska Airlines is closed down for the afternoon, so we'll be down there for a bit, and then for the evening segment, we'll go back upstairs and catch those evening flights before the end of the day.
What is so beneficial about massage?
Well, there are lots of benefits to people for massage therapy, circulation being one of them. That's the most important. It just helps get things moving, especially after being stuck on a flight for however many hours you may be stuck on a flight. It gets things moving again. It can just help with overall muscle aches and soreness, fatigue. I know that I travel a lot for teaching purposes, and sitting in an airplane chair is not the most comfortable or ergonomic. So it just helps with those low back aches or those arm pains that you get from keeping your arms in an awkward position typing away on the airplane.
What kind of things did you learn when you went through your training?
Well, I learned a lot. I specialize in injury treatment, so like I said, I'll be bringing a little bit of that stretching. We call it HASI, active release technique. It's something that we like to incorporate into everything we do because stretching a muscle under pressure is definitely the most effective way to benefit muscles. So something that can easily be done in a chair, and that's what I'll be doing.
And a typical massage takes about 15 minutes?
In the airport, it's going to be 15 minutes. For the first segment, you can choose 30 if you want to do so. And like I said, there'll be a hand and arm massage. These things are subject to change based on demand or requests. I know that some people love head massages or they love, you know, leg massages. So it'll just kind of be a work in progress. This is something that's going to be an experiment. We're going to see how it's received to the general public of Juneau. So requests and recommendations are very much welcome.
Do you have a website?
I do. It's about to be up and running. It's called JunoMassageBar.com. You can also find us on Facebook at Facebook/JunoMassageBar.
What does massage do for you, the masseuse?
We like the word massage therapist. And what it does for me, I love helping people. It's something that I've really enjoyed since I was very young. My family is actually made mostly of massage therapists. So I grew up around it. It's something that just brings healing, and it just makes you aware of your body. It keeps you out of injury. And specifically for me, I had scoliosis when I was younger, and through massage therapy and through chiropractic manipulation, I was able to become a straight and functioning adult. And so I like to share that with people and bring that same help to them, because it's something that can keep you from getting a surgery. I mean, it can help you from taking narcotics for years. It's so beneficial in so many ways. And I love sharing that story because it gives it more of a personal feel. You know, people understand that I'm the same as them. I experience the same pain, and it's just an overall sense of making people feel better, and that's what I love to do, and that's what I want to share with everybody here in Juneau.
What are your hours going to be?
They are subject to change, but as of right now, they're going to be 11:30 to 7:30. The mid-afternoon chunk from about 1:30 to about 5:30 will be spent downstairs, but 11:30 to about 1:30 will be upstairs, and downstairs will be 5:30 to 7:30 again.
Is massage something that's only for adults, or is it beneficial for children? Yeah.
With consent from an adult, you can definitely have it as a child. It's very great during development, especially if you're active in sports. I mean, children are no different than adults. They need body work just as much as adults do, but parents must be present for treatment.
All right, Sarah, thank you so much for coming down.
Thank you for having me.
Is there anything you'd like to add? I might have forgotten to ask.
We're starting on Monday. Please come by. The outside part that's not past security is easily accessible. It's just inside the doors to the right, and you are happy and welcome to come in, even if you are not traveling through the Juneau Airport.
Thank you for coming by.
Thank you.
This is Bird Note. On this December morning, imagine looking outside to see plowed fields and a cloud of wind-driven snow approaching. Undulating back and forth, the small cloud finally settles to the brown earth. Now it's clear that rolling white cloud isn't snow at all, but a flock of snow buntings. These birds bring the barren landscape to life. Sparrow-sized, snow buntings begin their lives amid the harsh conditions of the high Arctic. And unlike nearly all other songbirds on the continent, they're feathered in immaculate white, highlighted in winter with rich, rusty brown. They're prized winter visitors to the northern tier of states. Look for them along shorelines, in farmland, and open country, landscapes that mirror the Arctic tundra where they fledge their young. As specialized tundra breeders, however, snow buntings face the prospect of a shrinking nesting range as global climate change transforms far northern habitats. So what can one person do to make things better for buntings? Well, taken together, our actions, large and small, can benefit all birds, including snow buntings. To find out what you can do, come to our website, birdnote.org.
Yeah, hi, I'm Hal Geiger, and I like a lot of things about public media, but four things come immediately to mind. The thing I like the most is probably the way certain people are able to take these little boxes of capacitors and resistors and bring human warmth into my house and sometimes into my car. The second most important thing I like about public media is the news. I get a lot of my news about the outside world from KTOO. The third most important thing to me is new music, and I especially appreciate that on KXLL. And fourth, I appreciate the way public media has helped organizations that I've been a part of get the message out about things we're doing and planning for the community.
forecast for this afternoon, showers, high temperatures near 42 degrees. Forecast for tonight, more showers, rain, possibly heavy at times, low temperatures around 34 degrees. Forecast for Saturday, rain showers before noon, then rain and snow showers between 9 a.m. and noon, then snow showers likely afternoon. Forecast for Saturday night, snow showers likely, mostly before 3 in the morning. Forecast for Sunday, scattered snow showers before 3 p.m. Partly sunny skies with high temperatures near 26 degrees.
This is KTOO Juneau. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. We also rebroadcast on translators K276AF in the Mendenhall Valley and Auk Bay, K269AO in Lemon and Schweitzer Creeks, K210AM in Gustavus, K220BT in Hoonah, and K210AS in Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait. In Juneau, KTOO is on GCI Cable on digital channel 871. We're also online at ktoo.org. Support for national programming on KTOO comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
We hold these truths to be self-evident.
Instructions to all persons of Japanese ancestry.
That all men are created equal.
Both alien and non-alien.
Endowed with certain unalienable rights.
Will be evacuated from the following areas by 12 noon.
Dad first said it to me. The nail that sticks out is the one that gets hit. Hold These Truths by Jeannie Sakata is the story of Gordon Hirabayashi in his 60-year fight to stand up to power and discrimination. See it at Perseverance Theater, November 17th through December 4th. Tickets at the Jack, Hearthside Books, ptalaska.org, and 463-TIXS.
I'm Krista Tippett, host of On Being on KTOO News Juneau. On Being is a spacious conversation about the great animating questions of life. What does it mean to be human, and how do we want to live together in this remarkable century? Each week I speak with scientists and theologians, artists and activists, parents and poets. Please join me Sunday afternoons at 1 here on KTOO News Juneau.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. President-elect Donald Trump has been speaking on the phone with numerous world leaders since the election. NPR's Brian Naylor reports he talked to Taiwan's president, Tsai Ing-wen.
The phone call with Taiwan's president has raised eyebrows because the U.S. broke off diplomatic relations with Taiwan in 1979 when it recognized mainland China, which regards Taiwan as a breakaway province. And it's believed to be the first time a U.S. president or president-elect has spoken with a Taiwanese leader since then. A statement from the Trump Transition Office said the president-elect and Taiwan's president noted the, quote, close economic, political, and security ties between Taiwan.